Good morning. Welcome to Palm Springs Drive, the Church of Christ here that meets. We want to worship God and study His Word, love one another, and reach the lost. And we're so glad if you're visiting with us that you've come to do that with us this morning. Hope that you've been lifted up, that you've been encouraged and drawn closer to the Lord in some way. We're going to be talking about the fact that God is great all the time. And it's going to be kind of an interesting lesson in that it's an evidences lesson. And so I left a lot of blank space on your outline because you may just want to write some interesting facts down from an evidence standpoint that I think will really build your faith in God, give you more confidence in God's power. But the sermon also has kind of an unexpected twist to it as well. In Job 9, in verse 10, Job says that God does great things, unfathomable and wondrous works without number. Have you noticed how much the book of Job mentions the greatness of God? Job mentions God's greatness. Job's three friends mention the greatness of God. Elihu mentions God's greatness. And then the book actually climaxes with God Himself explaining and describing to Job how great He is. Why is that? Here's an illustration. If I were to ask you right now if you believe God is great, I think I know the answer. I think you'd all say, yes, of course God is great. Now imagine that you lose your job. You can't pay your bills. So your car gets repossessed. House gets foreclosed on. You get news from the doctor, you have a terminal illness. You only have a few years left to live. Then you find out that your spouse and your children died in a car accident. What would you think of God's greatness then? I hesitate to answer that question for myself. But I think the reason there's so much emphasis on the greatness of God in Job is because we are most tempted to doubt and question the greatness of God when we are suffering. Now, we can read a verse like Job 9, verse 10, and a lot of other things Job says, where Job speaks of God's greatness with his lips. But as the book progresses, we find that what Job is going through, all of the suffering that he goes through, exposes his doubt about whether God is really doing such a great job running his world. It's easy, easy to believe God is great when everything is going great for us. But what I want us to see in this lesson is that God is great all the time, whether things are going well for us or not. That's a hard lesson to learn. But it's one of the core lessons in Job, and it's a lesson Job himself needed to learn. There are three basic aspects of God's greatness in Job, and they all actually come from Job's own mouth. So look, for instance, in Job 26. That's where we're going to begin this morning, in Job chapter 26, because in Job 26, the second part of this chapter, Job speaks about God's power in creation. Job 26 and verse 7 says that God stretches out the north over empty space and hangs the earth on nothing. It's easy to take it for granted, but we walk outside and we look up and we see the sun during the day and we see the moon there at night, and they're just hanging there in the air. There are no strings attached to them. There's no human being controlling those things. It seems like they are kind of set on a cycle, on a pattern that just repeats every single day. And the same is true of the earth. It's just hanging there. Now think about for a moment how much the earth weighs. Now technically weight in space is a little hard to calculate with the gravitational issues. Many people talk about the mass of the earth, but you can use equations to calculate the earth's weight. It's 13 with 24 zeros after it in pounds. 13 with 24 zeros. Now, that number is pretty meaningless to us because we can't even begin to wrap our minds around a number so big. So it helps me to kind of work backwards, right? So if you take the average weight of a human being on the earth, it's roughly 180 pounds. Most of us could probably lift an average human being, put a human being on our backs and carry that weight. Well, let's put a human being in a car now. Can you lift the person and the car? No. Let's put that human in a car on I-4. Can we lift the human in the car in the entire I-4 interstate? Let's put a human being, someone thinks they can. That's impressive. Let's take the person in a car on a road, put them on a mountain. Could we lift the person in the car on the road and the mountain? Could we lift all of those things? How about the state? The actual state, one of the 50 states in the United States that that particular person lives in that's driving in the car on the road on the mountain, can we lift the state? How about the continent that that state is located on? How much does a continent weigh? How about all of the continents combined? Now, if you have that in your mind and you're imagining that, that's still only 30% of the earth. Because we haven't even talked about the other 70% that's covered by water and the land that's underneath that water. And even if you have that picture in your mind, that's still only the surface of the earth. That's the outside of the earth. We haven't even talked about the inside of the earth. It's just hanging there in the air. I understand. Our science textbooks teach us that it's the sun's gravitational pull that keeps the earth in orbit. But does that fact make it any less amazing? Brethren, let me say, let us never allow cute little diagrams in a science textbook diminish our view of God's power. When the very first astronauts passed over the surface of the moon and saw the earth rise for the first time in history, they reverently read from Genesis 1:1, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." John Glenn, when he later looked out the window of the space shuttle Discovery at the earth, said, quote, "To look out at this kind of creation and not believe in God is to me impossible." That's just the earth. We haven't even talked about the empty space Job mentions in this verse, which also contains the stars and other planets. In the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, I highly recommend you get that book. There's a great illustration. If you were to count up all the grains of sand on every single beach on this planet, that would be roughly equivalent to the number of stars in our universe. But you see, the stars in the universe aren't packed tightly together like the grains of sand. The average distance between each star is 30 trillion miles. Now, let's try to wrap our heads around that for a second. It's still going to be hard. But our space shuttle travels at 5 miles per second. Even that is amazing, right? That our human space shuttle can travel at 5 miles per second. Now, if you were to get in a space shuttle that goes 5 miles per second, if you were to get on that spaceship 2,000 years ago during the time of Christ and you were to begin your journey toward another star, by this time you would only be 1/100th of a way there. Because as opposed to the grains of sand that are tightly packed together on our beaches, it takes, at the speed of 5 miles per second, 200,000 years to travel from one star to another. And there are billions of stars. God stretches out those stars far beyond our ability to even begin to comprehend. Verse 8, he wraps up the waters in his clouds and the cloud does not burst under them. Again, We see rain clouds all the time, and we see the cute little diagrams in the textbooks, and we take them for granted. But have you ever just stopped to marvel at how those clouds hold so much water, and they don't just burst under the weight and cause us all to drown? The average cumulus cloud weighs 1.1 million pounds. So you're walking around here on the earth under billions of pounds of water. And yet, it's just floating up there in the air. And it doesn't burst on us and drown us all in a heartbeat, which it could. God wraps up the waters in those clouds. That was very interesting language used later in Job, which we'll get to on Wednesday night, but I'll show you a preview here. Job 38. Who can count the clouds by wisdom or tip the water jars of heavens, of the heavens? When the dust hardens into a mass and the lumps of earth stick together. I love that. He calls the clouds the water jars of heaven. So that he keeps that water up there so that we don't drown. But then right at the perfect time, he kind of just tips them over, pours out the water that we need when he sees that the earth is, you know, getting kind of clumps of clay just kind of sticking together and dry and needs that water. Verse 12, he quieted the sea with his power. By his understanding, he shattered Rahab. In ancient times, pagans believed that their gods defeated the god of the sea, called Rahab or Leviathan, depending on what language they spoke. And when their gods defeated the sea god, it quieted and calmed the seas and allowed human beings to live on the earth. That was kind of their view of things. But Job is saying God is the one who controls and calms the sea and who makes the earth inhabitable for human beings. Later, again, in Job 38, God asks this question to Job. Who enclosed the sea with doors? I placed boundaries on it and set a bolt and doors. And I said, thus far you shall come, but no farther. And here shall your proud waves stop. The earth is 70% covered by water. Yet that water stays back and does not swallow up the dry land. God is the one who keeps it there. The water only comes so far because of God. In Genesis chapter 1, you remember that the earth was, it actually started out covered with water, but God separated the land by gathering the waters, and the land emerged so that mankind would have a place to live. God put a bolt on the doors of the ocean to hold it back, to create a boundary for man so that we would not drown. And of course, in Genesis chapter 6, when mankind sinned greatly against the Lord, he exercised his power to remove the bolts and to take away the boundaries of the ocean and flood the earth again with water and destroyed everything in the process. The depth and the power of the ocean is beyond our ability to fathom, and it scared the ancient people to death. And it should scare us when we really appreciate the magnitude of the ocean. Yet God controls every wave. And then Job says in verse 14, these are just the fringes of his ways. How faint a word we hear of him. Even when you look out at what this planet communicates about God, it's just a faint word. Doesn't even touch the hem of the garment of how great God is. He says, we can't even understand the power of thunder, let alone anything else. There's so many things we cannot understand about God's power. And I'll just give you one last example. Our DNA contains actual information in a real language. If we walked along the beach and you saw just a simple message written in the sand, like Brian was here, we wouldn't assume, well, hey, that's just random. That must have just happened. Random chance over time, billions of years produced this intelligible message with letters in a particular order and language. No, we wouldn't say that. We would say, well, Brian wrote that, or somebody named Brian put that there. This isn't a random thing. Well, the amount of messages, encoded messages in just a single-celled amoeba, one of the most basic organisms of life, is comparable to the amount of information in 1,000 Encyclopedia Britannicas. So we see a simple message, and we say, well, that somebody must have put that there. And then we see a message, the length and complexity of 1,000 encyclopedias and we say, scientists, atheists say, well, that must have just happened. In another illustration from I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, they talked about the amount of information encoded in the human brain. Just so that, I'm not talking about what we learn from books and all that, but just the already embedded information in our brains to allow them to do their job and to function properly. The illustration they gave was this. If you went to a stadium with 20,000 seats in it, imagine stacking 1,000 books in every single one of those 20,000 seats. It's 20 million books. That is how much information has been encoded into our brains in an actual language, as an actual message, encoded in our brains just so that they can do their job. Bill Gates, owner and founder of Microsoft, said this, quote, DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software we've ever created. Yet these are just the fringes of his ways. God does great things, unfathomable and wondrous works without number. Job 9 and verse 10. Now here's my question. Here's the turn in this lesson. When things are hard for us in life and we are suffering mightily, do any of these facts about God's power change? When life is not going well for us, has God lost his power? Now, again, intellectually, we would say, of course not, Brian, but emotionally, when we are suffering, it can feel like maybe God isn't that powerful, because if he were that powerful, then he would put an end to my misery and my suffering. But when we are suffering, the earth still hangs on nothing. The planets are still, while we're suffering, everything is still working in this world. God is great all the time. Now, on one hand, that may make us very uncomfortable, like it did for Job, because Job is thinking, if God is all-powerful, and Job knew intellectually that God was all-powerful, but he's wondering, why doesn't God exert that power in my situation? But then on the other hand, there's also great comfort, like there was for Job, in knowing that God has the power to help us at any moment if we will just trust and wait on him. God is great all the time, even when our life is not. Secondly, Job talks about God's wisdom. Look in Job 28, please. Job 28, just such an awesome chapter, one of my favorite chapters. This section in verses 1 through 11 is all about man's incredible ability to search out the treasures of this earth. So he says, for instance, verses 1 through 3, surely there is a mine for silver and a place where they refine gold. Iron is taken from the dust and copper is smelted from rock. Man puts an end to darkness and to the farthest limit. He searches out the rock in gloom and deep shadow. He sinks a shaft far from habitation. Forgotten by the foot, they hang and swing to and fro, far from men. New American Standard says, forgotten by the foot. It's almost this picture of people just kind of walk by the ground, the surface of the ground, and they have no idea there are men like hundreds of feet below them hanging in some shaft that they built. Because we have this ability to go deep into the heart of the earth and make these discoveries. He says at the very end of chapter 11, verse 11, what is hidden, he brings out to the light. Man has gone where no animal has gone. We've traveled to the depths of the earth to find precious metals, to find precious stones of all kinds. We've this amazing ability to explore and to discover and to uncover the hidden things in this world. Yet, verse 12, but where can wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? Man can't find wisdom. It doesn't matter how long he searches on the earth. How deep he goes into the sea or into the earth's core, it's not there for man to find. Even if man takes all the wealth that he's gained from all the precious metals and stones that he's gotten from the depths of the earth and he tries to buy wisdom somewhere on the earth, he can't even do that because no one has it. No one has it on the earth. Let me give you this illustration. Consider just how much we know about this world. All the scientific discoveries, all the brilliant professors and scholars from all of the top universities in this world, all of the books that have been written over the centuries about our observations and discoveries about this life. It's really hard to quantify just how much we have learned, how much we have discovered, how much we know as humans about this planet. But here's my question. Has anyone ever been able to answer the simplest questions of a child? Like, who are we? Why are we here? And what is our purpose? Not a single person has ever been able to answer that question. Oh, philosophers and scientists and the greatest thinkers of all time have tried in every generation to answer those questions. But ultimately, it's always just been speculation with no way to really know. This is why parents get frustrated when their children play that game where they keep asking why. Hey, Dad, why do we drive cars? Well, so we can get to where we need to go faster. Why do we need to get to where we're going faster? Well, son, because we want to be more efficient with our time. Well, why do we need to be more efficient with our time? Well, because we only have a limited amount of time here on the earth and we have to make the most of it. Well, why do we only have a limited amount of time here on the earth? Well, because we don't live forever on this earth. Well, why don't we live forever here on this earth? And with that question, this child just exposed the limits of human knowledge. Not just his parents' knowledge, not just, well, your parents are just not smart, and if he was smart, he would know that answer. No. No human knows that. No human knows that. If human beings are left on their own to answer just the most basic questions of life, we will always hit a dead end like that. We'll always run into a dead end. Even Stephen Hawking, arguably one of the smartest men on the planet and a professed atheist, in his book, The Grand Design, wrote this explanation for how the universe got here. And this is very short, just one sentence. Quote, because there is such a law as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Well, Phil Hart gave me a good book by John Lennox, who is a world-renowned Christian apologist or defender of the faith, and he has debates with people all the time. He wrote a book in rebuttal to Stephen Hawking's book, and Lennox's book was very small because he didn't have much work to do, but he basically, this is what he did. This was his basic argument against Hawking. He exposed the fact that Hawking can't answer the question, why is there such a law as gravity? So all he did was take Hawking back one step in his reasoning. And he asks, like a child would ask, why? Hawking says, because there is such a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Lennox just says, well, why is there such a law as gravity? And Hawking has no answer to that other than to say it's just because that's the way it is. And isn't that how it works in the parent-child relationship? When the child brings you to the limits of human knowledge, the parent has to eventually just say, that's just the way it is. It's just like that, just because. But the ultimate question is, why is it that way? That's the ultimate question. And not a single human being has ever known the answer to that question. As knowledgeable as we are limited in our understanding, even about the most basic questions in life, which is why he asks in verse 20, where then does wisdom come from? And where is the place of understanding? And then he says in verse 23, God understands its way and he knows its place, for he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. Real wisdom lies with God. He is the one with the answers that we cannot find ourselves. That's why we need the Bible, because we need revelation from someone who sees what we do not and cannot see. We need revelation from someone who understands what we do not understand and who has answers to questions that we do not have answers to. This is why I made the point in my sermon about a month ago that there can't be any real knowledge without God. Because if there is no God and we're left on our own as humans, we can't ultimately know if we're right about even the answers to the most basic questions of life. In other words, in order to really know anything, we need someone who knows everything to guide us and show us what we do not know. And here's my question. When we're suffering and we don't understand why it's happening and we're just so confused, is God confused? Does God not understand why it's happening? Intellectually, we're going to say, yes, he does know. He sees everything under the heavens. He knows exactly what's going on. He knows exactly why all this is happening to me. But emotionally, we may question God's wisdom because it just doesn't seem fair that this is happening to us. But when we are suffering, God is still wise and still has all the answers. That has not changed. God is great all the time. Now, again, on the one hand, that might make us very uncomfortable because, like Job, we might wonder, how could it possibly be wise for God to allow this to be happening to me? But then on the other hand, there's great comfort, like there was for Job, in knowing God does have the answers, which means our suffering is not just pointless or random, but there is a purpose behind it, whether we know what that purpose is or not. God is great all the time, even when our life is not. And thirdly, God's uniqueness. Look in Job 23, verse 13. Job says he is unique. He is unique. And who can turn him? And what his soul desires, that he does. The literal word here is one. It just says he is one in Hebrew. So some translations read he is unchangeable. But the idea seems to be that God is sovereign. He is the one in charge. He doesn't change his mind and he does what he pleases. In that sense, of course, he is unique from human beings. He is righteous and holy. He's not subject to mistakes like human beings are. It also means God says and does things that are very unexpected. And sometimes he does things and says things we do not like. When we're suffering, those are the times that we are most tempted to treat God as if he is like one of us, as if he is a fellow human being, as if he should do things the way we want them to be done, and then we get upset when he's not. In fact, I didn't put this on the outline, but it was such a fantastic verse that Adam brought up. Look in chapter 34. I'll just throw this in as a bonus, because this is really what Elihu's telling Job. Job has been treating God like a human being, and Job 33, verse 12, he says to Job, "Behold, let me tell you, you are not right in this, for God is greater than man." He's trying to get Job to see God is unique. You cannot treat him like a human being. And of course, Job intellectually would say amen to that. I know he's not a man. I get that. But emotionally, because of what he's going through, he does. He crosses that line. And I want to show you some of these examples. This is really going to set up our class for Wednesday night very well. Look in Job 9. I just want to show you some examples of Job treating God like a human being. Job 9, 23 and 24. Job 9, 23 and 24, Job says this about God. He says, "If the scourge kills suddenly, God mocks the despair of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked, and yet God covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, then who is it?" Job accuses God of mocking innocent people and blindfolding judges on the earth so that the wicked can get away with their wickedness. This is really what he's saying here. He's charging God with making mistakes in rendering judgment on the earth. And he believes his case, of course, is the prime example of God's mistake in error in judgment. Look in Job 19, verse 7. Job 19, verse 7, another example of this. Behold, I cry violence, but I get no answer. I shout for help, but there is no justice. He complains that God is not answering his prayer. He asks for help, but God won't help him. Look at one more example here, Job 24, verse 1. Job 24, verse 1. Why are times not stored up by the Almighty? And why do those who know him not see his days? He charges God with being unfair in how he renders judgment because, unlike the kings of the earth, God doesn't set up regular times for people to come to him so that he can kind of adjudicate their case and handle their disputes. And he wishes that's how God would do things. If God was really just, he would do it that way. And here's the result of it, verse 12. Because of that, verse 12, from the city men groan and the souls of the wounded cry out, yet God does not pay attention to folly. So these people are all suffering. These innocent people, they're suffering at the hands of the wicked, but God doesn't even pay attention to any of the wickedness that's causing them to suffer. What we see is, yes, Job is willing to admit God is great, but because of what he's going through, he crosses the line and treats God like a man who owes him an explanation, who needs to answer his prayer on his schedule, and who needs to change the way he handles things on this earth. Especially the way he's handling Job's situation. Here's my question. When we suffer, does God's uniqueness change? Does he somehow become like a human being that we can dispute with for not doing things the way we want them to be done? No, he does not. And again, intellectually, we know that, but emotionally we may treat God like a human being we can take to court and sue for negligence. But when we're suffering, God's ways are still higher than our ways. His thoughts are still higher than our thoughts because he is God and we are not. God is great all the time. And on one hand, that might make us uncomfortable. Because like Job, we may think God owes us an explanation for why this is happening to us. Question, does God owe us an explanation? No, he does not. We may expect our fellow man to owe us an explanation if our fellow man wrongs us. We demand that of human beings. But God is not a man. He is unique and he is sovereign. Question, is God obligated to fix things or answer our prayers on our timeline? No, he is not. Again, we may expect man, our fellow man, to work things out in a timely manner. And hey, we got a schedule to keep and you need to jump when I say jump. But God is not a man. He is unique and sovereign. And when we suffer, final question, doesn't mean that God has wronged us or that he has made a mistake. No, it does not. Again, we may be able to say that to our fellow man when we suffer at their hands, but God is not a man. He is unique and he is sovereign. The book of Job climaxes with God rebuking Job because Job proclaims God's greatness with his lips, but because of his suffering, he questions God's greatness in his heart. And it does come out in his lips as well. And of course, Job stayed faithful to God. He didn't rebel against God like so many do when they suffer. But he still questioned God's way of running this world. And God tells Job, and we'll see this on Wednesday night, that he is in no position as a human being to charge the creator of this world with not ruling his world properly. We may not like that message at all. And it may make us uncomfortable. I'll tell you, this lesson makes me uncomfortable. Even putting this lesson together makes me uncomfortable for a couple reasons. One, it's not immediately comforting when we're suffering to know that God is great. So please don't take from this lesson that I'm saying, next time you see someone suffering, you need to go to them and just say, hey, don't worry, God is great. That's not immediately what you want to think about when you're suffering. So I get that. It's not a dismissal of a person's suffering, but it is a truth that we need to hold on to. And the second reason it makes me so uncomfortable is because it makes us feel so vulnerable. Because we are so feeble, we are so weak in our knowledge and limited in our power and in our understanding. It is just incredibly humbling. It was for Job in Job 40. God wasn't even finished with his speeches yet, but halfway through God's speeches, God says, "All right, it's your turn to speak, Job. You've been waiting all this long. It's your turn. Go ahead. You have the floor." Here's what Job does with his floor. He says in Job 43 and 4, Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am insignificant. What can I reply to you? I lay my hand on my mouth." This lesson made Job very uncomfortable. But the lesson Job needed, and the lesson we all need, is that God is great, even when our life is not. God is great all the time. Would you take out your songbooks, please? Despite any initial discomfort that lesson gives us, once it really sinks in and you recognize that God is the one with all power and wisdom, you then begin to take comfort in knowing that God knows the exact time and the exact way to respond to our suffering and our situation. And God knew that the ultimate demonstration of His greatness would also be the ultimate answer to our suffering, which is Jesus on the cross for our sins. If you're here and you're not a Christian, you don't have that hope that Jesus gives us, that one day we won't have any more suffering. If you don't have Jesus, all you have is your suffering. You have no hope. You have no peace or joy, but you can have that this morning. Jesus died not only to show us He can relate to our suffering, but to show us He can release us from our suffering as well. In the end, when we all end up in heaven, there will be no more suffering there. And even in the meantime, we have a God who loves us, who is great and powerful, and who does care. If you want a relationship with that God, you can have that this morning. If you'll come forward and let Him know that Jesus is the Lord of your life, that you're willing to repent of your sins, confess His name, be baptized, washing away all of your sins. And if you've already done that, and you're a Christian and you've allowed suffering to warp your perspective about God like it did for Job, won't you restore a fresh perspective this morning? And restore God to the position of greatness that He has always held in your heart. Put Him back there this morning. Come forward and let us know how we can help you while we stand and sing.